I'm Tom O'Connell, and this is my wife, Annie, and somebody asked me where we met. So we got started on a completely extracurricular little recapitulation of our courtship, which was year before last, was it, Annie? No, it was a few more years than that. We did. All right. What I want you to do, Annie, is you don't get very many lines in this particular play.
Oh. Are they good lines?
You have just one line, which is, you may say it with as much expression as you wish. I'll tell you the line. You may think of it and say it any way you wish. Are we ready? Come on in. I've got some more printings of the poems, which are not going to actually be read right now anyway, so we'll share them when we get to reading some of them. So, we're getting started here with a little dialogue between my wife Annie and me reading Emily Dickinson's lines, the line I have given to her was originated and scripted by me.
Oh, okay.
It's very...
So, do I use your name at the beginning of it?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I start out? Tom, I know you love me, but why do you love me?
Why do I love you, miss? Because. The wind does not require the grass to answer, whereby when he pass, she cannot keep her place, because he knows, and do not you, and we know not enough for us. The wisdom it be so. The lightning never asked an eye wherefore it shut when he was by, because he knows it cannot speak. And reasons not contained of talk there be, preferred by daintier folk. The sunrise, miss, compelleth me, because he's the sunrise. And I see. Therefore, then, I love thee. Actually, that's completely extempore in the sense of preparation. I was reading through this lovely biography of Emily Dickinson's by Thomas Johnson, who is the editor of her complete poems, and also the editor of... This is a plug, Final Harvest, which is an excellent paperback book, which Betty has, and which you may purchase at a very reasonable price in the Holden Village Bookstore. How's that for a plug? So if you're interested in her poems, this is a very good volume to get. So I was reading through it, and I came to some poems on love, and I came upon this one, and I had not read it for a long time, and I just hadn't remembered it. So I had to read it. And since you had started me talking about younger and happier days, I wanted to start off with that one. But because in the distribution of the poems that I'm talking to you about, there are several that do not fit tidily into any of the categories, I want to share with you three poems that I just can't resist sharing with you, even though they are not under the categories which I have listed as nature, God, love, and immortality, in no special order. So I want to share these with you. And one is a poem that I mentioned, indeed that I said, Robert Frost always referred to saying a poem as just that, not reciting, saying a poem. I want to say this poem to you all, although I did mention it in a different context last class, last session. See what you make of it. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased by explanations kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. One more time. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased by explanations kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. What do you think she's getting at there? Well, thank you,
yeah.
Howard.
Yeah.
What do you think she's getting at there?
Let's just see if there are questions about it, or if you'd like to explore it for a minute. You just can't be too blunt because people can't take it. Nancy, what are you going to say?
The truth is so dazzling that you can't take it in. The line about blind at the end. So.
Mm-hmm. You can't handle it. It's like the sun, looking directly at the sun, or looking directly at an eclipse. The truth is really, this isn't really her metaphor here, but the inference is clear. It's like an eclipse that you can't look at because it will blind you. It is so dazzling. She says, what she says about that is kind of interesting. It's making an analogy. As lightning to the children eased by explanations kind.
Yeah, I didn't get it.
As lightning to the children.
You ease their fright by explaining what it is.
Exactly.
You explain what it is, or you explain if the child is very small and couldn't understand it. You ease his or her fear by saying some kind of metaphorical explanation that will keep the child from being terribly frightened.
I was thinking even of explanations kind as that which it may not be verbal presence.
Oh.
By explanations
similar
kind? Could be.
Similar.
Could be. Could simply be just taking the child's head and reassuring it, right? Saying, yeah, particularly a very young child who wouldn't understand the words anyway. The child is frightened by the lightning, and perhaps the thunder goes with it, of course. That's Emily Dickinson's shorthand. When you talk about lightning, you're talking about thunder, too, which is more frightening to children. And taking the little child's hand and just reassuring it without words, very good. Yeah, the explanations can be articulate or inarticulate, unarticulated. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
I like it because she's not interested in partial truths. I like, tell all the truth. Mm-hmm. Tell all the truth.
Yes.
So
right.
Maybe we can take little pieces of the truth, but all the truth at all points.
She wanted all the truth. She thought we must tell all the truth. She's a terribly honest person. Terribly honest person. Pardon me?
If I do it, so you slant it a little bit.
Now, what about the slant?
What about the, how do you, what do you see in the slant?
Slant mean partial, cut off parts of it, or slant to us today means you put a partiality in it, sort of slant it. But I think she meant parts of it, like
parts of it, or
no? You're not hitting it straight on. You're kind of feeding it in a little more gradually on a slant. You do something that at a like angle, and it's not a right angle. You do it a little more gradually.
So like or oblique, right? Instead of saying, for example, let's think of the way we discuss hell. We discuss hell. Christians discuss hell. But we don't discuss hell the way Cotton Mather discussed hell. Right? That would be telling the truth without a slant, you know? You will burn forever in hell's fire in such agony that you cannot even conceive of it. See, that's hell as Cotton Mather described it, roughly paraphrased. But we find a more oblique way to say it, still trying to keep us in mind of how horrid it's probably going to be. But we tend to use a metaphor for it. We tend to use softer language. We tend by indirection, we keep it from being quite so harsh. My father passed away. Better still, your father. I understand your father passed away. You don't want to say to the person who's recently bereaved, your father died. Your father was murdered. Your father was assassinated. Your father was, you might say, somebody else, that man was butchered. That accident just butchered him. But you'd never say that directly to the daughter of that man. And you would say, I understand, dear friend, that your father passed on. That would be telling the truth slant. You have to admit the death, but you don't necessarily use the strongest word that might describe adequately what indeed happened to him, that he was destroyed by the automobile accident, let's say.
Right. It seems to me also she's saying that you can talk in metaphors.
Which passed on is.
Right. But in the what she does in the poetry is talk about enormous, huge events and occasions, truths. But she doesn't talk about God and heaven. She talks about a flower.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the flower is representing something.
But you remember, Annie, that yesterday when we talked about this poem, I said another poem, which I will just share the first couple of lines for those who weren't present yesterday. She, as a person who wants the truth, she doesn't herself want it slant. She doesn't want it slant. She has to tell it slant because she knows it'll dazzle other people, but she can take it straight. She has a poem that starts like this. I like a look of agony because I know it's true. Pretty strong. I like a look of agony because I know it's true. The suggestion being is one reads on into the poem that one can simulate anything else, but you can't simulate agony.
I'm moving in a different direction. I don't know. I mean, that the slant what was the word for circling?
Tell all the truth, but sell it slant. Success in circuit lies.
Success in circuit lies. If truth is beyond, if truth is mystery, ultimately, the way to tell all the truth, in fact, is not to come at it directly, to give the impression that the truth is within my grasp, but rather to indicate that somehow I am moving toward it, just like everyone else is, because ultimately the truth is beyond.
Yeah, that's very good. It's particularly good because one of her favorite words was...
I turned that around.
Want to turn it around the other way for me, Annie, please? And I want to do something that I did yesterday, which was picture, if you will, how fortunate can you be, original scholarship taking place in your very midst. Not quite in your midst in the sense that when I was preparing for a talk on God, as Emily Dickinson saw him, I observed that her definition of circumference, and circumference is one of her very favorite words, was very close to what you're talking about there.
It's really insightful. Circumference was her favorite word, and circumference meant several things for her. One of the things circumference meant was vast distances. Another thing was her perception of everything that exists, spiritual, physical, cerebral, her perception of everything. So here is a chart that I drew. Many of you weren't present when I talked at Vespers the other night about Emily Dickinson, when I talked about the centrality of the Bible to her language. She depended on no book as much as she depended on the Bible, much more than any other book. The second place would be her hymn book. And her absorption with circumference, which is her vision of everything way, way, way out there, as far as her perception could reach, her thought could reach, her spiritual insight could reach, her eyes could see the farthest star. I did a little chart which went like this. At the center, we have the Bible. Out here, at the farthest distance of her being able to conceive, is circumference. And here's the leap of imagination that I share with you. There's nothing particularly original, I guess, about this. Her Bible is central to her poetry. Circumference is what interested her most, her favorite word, the word she most liked to explore. So I drew some lines. These are This is an Emily Dickinson poem. That's an Emily Dickinson poem. So, we have the Bible as the hub, circumference as the wheel itself, the outside of the wheel, and the spokes are her poems. How do you like that? Huh? I'm going to write it up. But that's really a good insight on your part, because that is a lot of what she talks about in her indirection goes to that fascination with circumference. That is wave, which is way, way, way out there. And she wrestles with how the two relate.
Then that would say that passing away is a euphemism as well as an analogy. And maybe a euphemism rather than an analogy, in that she may not use passing away, but say what needs to be said and that is appropriate to whatever she is writing at the time. Because
I do indeed. She would use a fresh metaphor,
right,
which brought to bear her insights into what the process was, and she does
including the one for whom she is writing, as well as for herself, whatever that circumstance might be in terms of what her intention is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's reaching the circumference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well. Very good. Yeah. She would never use passing on or passing away.
I'd say what she did say, because it's perfect for what he just said. Wait, you know what she said,
no.
What her last note was, and it's on her gravestone?
No.
The thing that she sent a note just before she died to her favorite cousins, whom she had known since childhood, who were middle-aged women by this time, as she was. She died at 55. And the note was four words. Little cousins, call back. I did mention.
Call back.
Call back.
Now, call back is not an avoidance.
No.
Call back is direct, but call back is fresh. but callback is direct. Callback is more complete than dying.
Yes.
In terms of
yes.
what it says.
It carries with it a conventional metaphor, doesn't it? We use the metaphor all the time. Christians think of themselves as being, we think of ourselves as being called back. We have been with God. We've been lucky
we're
enough to be with God.
Here.
And yes, indeed.
We're strangers
and we shall, yeah,
right.
we shall return
it's
to paradise.
Biblical.
Yes, indeed. Call back is very biblical. And indeed, that's why I read it at Vespers, because it picked up my theme of her dependence on the Bible. Call back was very much a New England Puritan biblical look at the process of death. Now, I read it at Vespers because I thought it would carry that message. But when I talked about God, I expatiated on it a little bit and said, which I think is another, and I don't want to come across here as the most original thinker about Emily Dickinson that ever lived, because I'm dependent upon some other guys a lot, right? But I don't know that I've ever read, but I did a column, newspaper column, about her birthday on May 15th. And I started to play with that we have a rubbing of her gravestone, which is now in the Seattle Public Library in connection with a presentation of a show that Annie directed of Ruth McCree Schultz playing the Belle of Amherst. Some of you know Ruth, I'm sure. So that rubbing is there. And the rubbing is Little Cousins Called Back. So I was doing a column about that, and it occurred to me that maybe, as is so often the case, she is playing with the whole concept. She was never herself entirely persuaded that she should be a worshiping Christian. She wrestled with it all her life, as most of us never dream of wrestling. She wrestled with it every day, lots of the time, and wrote some of her greatest poems about trying to see her way clear to the kind of belief that most people in Amherst, Massachusetts had at the time. So I developed this idea. Little Cousins is playing, because they weren't little anymore. She used to address them as little cousins when she was a child and they were children. And she was using what might have been a kind of nickname. If you call somebody Jimmy, I said, you might call him Jimmy even though he's 85 years old. You knew him when he was Jimmy, and he was a little kid. You grew up with him. You're a sibling, a close friend, cousin. You call him Jimmy. So you say little cousins. That's kind of playing. Then called back may mean right on the surface what it means. I believe at this point, as I reach my final hours, that I am going to be called back and I shall be in heaven. However, she may also be playing with the idea, am I indeed going to be called back, because her cousins knew very well about her doubts and about her fundamental problem was that in that harsh new, that Old Testament God and the worship of him in the Puritan forms that obtained in the 19th century in Amherst, Massachusetts and other small towns was a pretty self-denigrating religion. Self-denigration took a greater role than almost anything else. And she could not see herself as that horrendous sinner that one had to see oneself as being in order to worship in the form that her sister and her father and her brother and mother did. So she rejected that form of worship. So whether she was playing this kind of game with God, and she has many poems about playing games with God right up until the very end, was the thing that I explored in that column. Whether she meant it or whether she was playing, we will probably never know. But it's certainly open to possibility. It's open to possibility. One other poem that I wanted to say for you, and I do want to leave a bit of time for talking about a few of the love poems, and I have in mind very much that we have Vespers at 7:30.
So don't worry about my not letting you out. If I go over it, Annie will throw something at me to let me know that it's time. But there is another poem that's one of my favorites that I'd like to share with you, which is one of her most famous poems. Maybe some of you may have heard of it. It goes like this. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated, dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant burst of trumpets sound agonizing clear. One more time. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated dying on whose forbidden ear the distant sound of trumpets burst agonizing clear. Yeah, certainly that's there. Success is counted sweetest by those who never do succeed.
Remember one day we were at the Seattle Center, there's a little football field and track. It's just charming. It sits in the back of the opera house. It's this sort of perfect little field. And there was a track meet with high school students. And we saw the boy who came in second in the race.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, it was interesting because there were all those people around, but it was as if he were completely alone. And this despair was so enormous. It wasn't unsportsmanly, it was just that he was so completely
bereft
himself. And I thought of that poem and I thought about him, and I think that one of the things that's hard about losing is that then the event is not over. The person who succeeds, the event is over, you go on to the next thing. But when you don't succeed, you're simply left with that failure to contend with. And it's very hard to put it away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good analogy, yeah.
Maybe she's saying that success is sweeter for those who aren't quite as talented as
who don't make it.
In other words, a duffer golfer who makes a chip shot that is magnificent enjoys that more than Jack Nicklaus does. He does it every day.
And he doesn't enjoy it as much as the guy who's such a bad duffer that he never makes it. That he never really makes a superb golf shot. Maybe knocks in a chip every once in a while, but he knows there's a bit real element of luck in it.
Or does Lee Iacocca enjoy his success as much as a salesman who just made a big sale of a voyage of vain?
Mm-hmm. Well, what about Lee Iacocca's classmate, who tried to make it in business and somehow never could put it together, and he never has figured out why? And success in terms of prestige and money and the feeling of being able to do good and being able to contribute to his church or whatever success means to him, means more to him than it can ever make to Lee Iacocca, who has achieved such enormous success. Right. Look at her metaphors to describe it. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. If you and I are eating nectars, but we eat nectars all the time. Not only that, but it's after a big meal and we're having nectars for dessert. Whereas here is a man who is literally starving. He is desperate.
Right.
Food. He's been out in the desert and he hasn't been able to get in, and here's this lovely nectar. Who is going to appreciate it? Who's going to understand? Who's going to be able to comprehend the nectar? To savor every taste that it has, comparatively. Not you or you, see? Right? Whatever the fruit, pick your favorite fruit, see? Yeah? And then she says, not one of all the purple hosts who took the flag today, the victor, hey, I stand up here with the flag. Huh? And do I know what victory means as clearly as that poor fellow down there, wounded to the point of dying, who hears me, who sees me up here with the flag and hears my trumpets blow for victory? Who knows what victory means better? This fellow up here or that person down there? Fellow down there. And indeed, you could argue that that experience of losing is a more fulfilling experience than the winning. I think that's in the poem. The uses of adversity, the person, although dying, has learned, has experienced something that may be more important than the victory. Have you ever noticed, to make it a kind of a homely thing for you, have you ever noticed that you really wanted something desperately and you strove for it and you worked for it? Maybe it's a job, or maybe it's something that you've wanted and somebody gives it to you. But it's even better, I think, if you think of striving for it, working for it. A job is a good analogy. Finally, by George, you get the job. And you go to the office, and there you are in that job, and is this what it was all about? I mean, this is nice, yeah. I got a little bigger office, or I'm making a little more money, or I've got two secretaries instead of one, or whatever. But, it still is work. It's not quite what I hoped. I think that's what she's getting at there.
I'm curious about the use of the word purple host. Does that carry the connotation of purple as in royal, as an exaggeration, or is it something specific?
I think so. Purple has always had a special connotation of rarity, because you can't make a purple dye except from very, very rare kinds of creatures. And in Mexico, the history of Mexico, the Aztecs and the Mayas, for example, purple was reserved for the most illustrious, the royalty, because it was so rare. And it stands for something, boy, really extraordinarily prestigious. She entitled only about 30 poems, roughly 30 she gives titles to out of her 1,775 poems. So she rarely titled them.
This was not. The word that sticks for me is success, because it starts with success. And the word that comes to my mind is competition. Success competition, which is really the reverse. That's not there in this.
Isn't it?
At least for the dying person.
Isn't it?
Well, maybe it is, but...
Seems to me he's failed in the ultimate competition, which is war.
Maybe. But maybe the sweet savor of success is precisely because there is a realization that competition is not the way.
I don't see it in this poem.
Maybe not.
I don't see it in this poem. Indeed, I see it as a poem stressing the difference between success in competition and failure in competition. Well, now, maybe you've gone beyond it. Obliquely, then, if you say that the failure is, in a way, a more meaningful experience than the victory, then maybe you're saying that the competition itself was not all that important. And maybe the competition is not necessarily the way.
The person who wins is not going to recognize that, because the opportunity for failure hasn't been.
Well,
the opportunity for failure was there, but I think Annie's point's well taken on your point, and that is that it's gone now. You have an experience, a victorious experience, you move on to the next one, right?
Right.
You move on to the next one. The other person, instead of moving on to the next one, is to use a line from a kind of trite, popular song. The loser is alone on the street of regret. Remember that old Vaughn Monroe song? Hey, when you're alone on the street of regret, when your eyes are dim and your cheeks are wet, when you know you've been wrong and it's too late to mend, you just stumble along wondering where it will end. So it doesn't stop. That song came to my mind as Annie said that, which I think is right on. The person who loses, unless he dies, goes on carrying that regret of not having won. Well, I wanted to share those two with you, and I want to. I'm not going to have time for the other one. Boy, I'm sorry too. The trouble with Emily Dickinson is there is so much. It is such
a
feast.
What's the first line of the other?
What's the first line of?
The one you're not doing.
Boy, you're going to get me started, Nancy. Crumbling is not an instant act. How do you like that for a line? I got to share the poem with you now. See what you did, Nancy?
We won't talk about it.
We're not going to talk about it, all right? Not a word, but I cannot. I've done you, Nancy. This is in your handout. Some of you have a handout. Would you share it with those who don't so that you can get the impact of it? It's on page 3. The only thing I want to say about this poem is, have you ever known a person who all of a sudden goes to pieces? Has a fall from grace or a fall as to health or a fall as to mental capacity or is disgraced, and all of a sudden this great person that you have known and admired is in jail or is in an asylum or is in an alcoholic recuperation place. And you say, how in the world could that happen? All of a sudden, bang! Yesterday he was wonderful. He was the king of the world, and today he commits suicide. How could that happen all of a sudden? What Emily Dickinson says is, it's not the way it was, folks. Crumbling is not an instance act, a fundamental pause. Dilapidation's processes are organized decays. 'Tis first a cobweb on the soul, a cuticle of dust, a borer in the axis, an elemental rust. Ruin is formal, devil's work, consecutive and slow. Fail in an instant, no man did. Slipping is crash's law. I mean, what do you say about that poem? Huh? What do you say?
Thank you, Tom.
What do you say? That poem, you know, her definition of poetry was, if I feel that the top of my head comes off, I know it's poetry. One or two brief ones before we go to Vespers on love. And we gave you one of the nicest ones that Annie and I read, the outset. I'd like to read a very simple one that I enjoy, even though it doesn't have any of the profundity, but it's a very nice metaphor. Let's see if you don't agree. Love poem now. We shift the mood. It's written in 1860 at a just when she was starting the flood of her peak years of poetry. My river runs to thee, blue sea, wilt welcome me? My river waits reply, O sea, look graciously, I'll fetch thee brooks from spotted nooks. Say, sea, take me. Isn't that nice? The love metaphor being the ocean, being the lover, and I bring to you, sea, everything there is, these brooks way back up here under these mountains starting to flow down, going down Lake Chelan and all the way to eventually to the sea. I'll bring it all to you. Take me. Take me. Nice little poem. A couple of... A charm invests a face imperfectly beheld. The lady dare not lift her veil for fear it be dispelled. But peers beyond her mesh and wishes and denies, lest interview annul a want that image satisfies.
Oh. Bring back hats.
Bring back hats. Bring back to use a, to give an old-fashioned kind of interpretation. Bring back bathing suits that cover part of the body. Unless you have a 17-year-old body that can be any hour on the northern coast of Spain last year up near San Sebastian, where topless is the way to go, right? Annie didn't. That's the way to go. And what you realize is that topless is great for the 17-year-old girls. But for anybody else, it's not so great. It's much better if it's covered up. Huh? At least in part. And it's the same idea, right? If you see a woman and she's got a veil, it's like, ooh, isn't she lovely? Isn't she interesting? Isn't she mysterious? Oh, I would love to be able to see that face. But maybe it's better not to. So now we extend the metaphor a lot farther. A lot farther. About as far as you can go. About as far as you can go. It's a profound poem. Did the harebell loose her girdle to the lover bee? Would the bee the harebell hollow, much as formerly? Did the paradise persuaded yield her mote of pearl? Would the Eden be an Eden, or the Earl an Earl? One more time. Harebell, of course, is a flower. I'm sure most of you know. So we're talking about a flower and a bee. That's the start. Did the harebell loose her girdle to the lover bee? Would the bee the harebell hallow, much as formerly? Did the paradise persuaded yield her mote of pearl? Would the Eden be an Eden, or the Earl an Earl? What do you think she's getting at here? How about the first stanza first? Did the harebell loose her girdle to the lover bee? Would the bee the harebell hallow, much as formerly? It's an old, old lesson for our young ladies, right? If you give yourself away, it may be that the young man will not have the same attitude toward you as if you are chaste. An old, old moral. Often honored in the breach these days, to the sorrow of many of our women. Might be. But listen to me. Okay, very good, very good. The quest, right. The quest, excellent. Now here, see how far she carries it. Did the paradise persuaded yield her moat of pearl, would the Eden be an Eden, or the Earl an Earl? What is Eden? Garden of Eden? Paradise? Heaven. What's the Earl?
He's a noble.
Yes. Who is the noblest of the noble in heaven? God. So, we're talking about Eden, heaven, we're talking Earl, God. So, if she has argued in several other poems that we've shared, her distress that God will not reveal himself. Why doesn't God come forward and tell me? If this is a game, that's okay, God, I'll play the game. She talks to him very intimately. I'll play the game. But what if the game, what if I play the other way and I decide that it's not in earnest and I learn after the game is over and I die that the game was for real? Calamity for me, right? So you ought not to play these games with us if it's for real, she says. See? So now she's in effect, she's saying, she's taking the other view. She says, if indeed paradise were revealed to us and we knew all about it and God were to reveal himself without the mystery, without the perplexing paradoxes that we encounter as we try to see our way through to clear to God, would it be as attractive to us? Would we seek it in the way that we do? If there wasn't any mystery with God, would God be essential in your lives? Maybe not.
I think she's going even farther than that. God wouldn't be God.
Yeah? Yeah?
She says, would the
Earl
be an Earl?
Would the Earl be an Earl, right? Familiarity breeds contempt. But she says someplace else that once we know a riddle, we despise it. The riddle is intriguing until we know it. When we know it, we despise it. Isn't that good? So these are love poems of a sort because they are relating to the relationship between the sexes. I have time for just one more before we go to Vespers. Which one to choose? Which one to choose? Well, I'll choose the one that we have in our handout so that you can share. I've said to those who've been to sessions before, I like to have you have the experience of sharing some of these poems that are on the page, and I like to have you share some of them that are not on the page, and you have to do it by sound. You have to do it by my reading it, because that's why she wrote poetry. That's why all poets write poetry. It is to be heard, to have the sound be what is an integral part of the poem. So the way most of us share poetry, particularly these days, reading it on the page, is not the way it ought to be. This poem is on page 11, the penultimate page. For those of you who can share this, I'm sorry that I don't have more. I'll just read it and then we won't have very long to discuss it because we must go next door. If you were coming in the fall, I'd brush the summer by with half a smile and half a spurn as housewives do a fly. If I could see you in a year, I'd wind the months in balls and put them each in separate drawers for fear the numbers fuse. If only centuries delayed, I'd count them on my hand, subtracting till my fingers dropped into Van Diemen's land. If certain, when this life was out, that yours and mine should be, I'd toss it yonder like a rind and take eternity. But now, uncertain of the length of this that is between, it goads me like the goblin bee that will not state its sting. It's to a lover who has passed on, use our metaphor, our euphemism, and indeed it was written after a man she loved a great deal had died. And she's talking about her inexpressible despair at his leaving, if it were only a season, if you were coming next fall, no problem. If you were coming next year, hey, I could wait, I'm patient. Even if it were centuries, I would not consider that at all a problem. If I could even be sure, if I could be 100% sure that you and I indeed would be joined, as so many lovers hope they will, pray they will, and with great faith believe they will be joined in heaven. If she could really believe that, also she would say, I will wait patiently. But since I don't know when or if, she doesn't state the if though, because her assumption is a love like ours cannot possibly be terminated like that by your death. She cannot believe that, as most real lovers can't believe it can ever end. It goads me like the goblin bee that will not state its sting. The worst kind of bee is the one that hovers around us and bothers us and vexes us and won't land. You reach the point, don't you, where you say, sting me, but stop bothering me. So she comes to this homely metaphor, this homely bucolic metaphor, country metaphor. I'd rather have the certainty that it's never going to happen. Terrible though that news would be, than never to know. Never to know. Let's go to Vespers. Okay.